Lucas Barfield.
And I'm Uncle Dig.
Yeah. Welcome to the Cannabis Corner. And we are back on the Cannabis Corner. My name is Lucas Barfield, and I am joined by my co-host, Uncle Dig. How's it going today, Uncle Dig?
It is going great. The sun is shining, and the wind is blowing, causing the leaves to almost wave at me out my window.
Yeah, and we finally have some sunshine over the weekend. It rained Memorial Day weekend, but then we got a little bit of sun. It's supposed to be sunny for the next couple weeks, or not a couple weeks, but kind of off and on rain, where we're kind of moving into the summer dry spell. Yeah. But I finally was able to get my garden out, Dig, and it took – I wasn't able to do it over the whole spring because it just really gets muddy. I'm doing this new way of gardening called no-till gardening. I don't know if people have heard about this. I first heard about this on Radio Tacoma. Have you ever heard of this, Dig, the no-till gardening?
Yeah. I'm like vaguely familiar with it, yeah.
Yeah, it's basically you just take some type of substance. I use the cardboard paper bags that I get from the grocery store, and then you lay those out in like a row over the top of your bed from last year.
It's like sheet composting as well.
Yeah, and so what it does is it blocks all the plants from growing up from below, like weeds. Then you take some dirt and compost and everything, and this is what I do. And then you mix it all together, and then you spread that out over the paper bag rows, and then you plant your seeds there. And then that fresh dirt, there's no weeds and everything in it. So the only thing that comes up is the seeds that you put in. And then the theory is, year to year, as you keep doing this, you kind of get like a pancake of soil layers in there. And then you start getting all the fungus, mycelia, and all the bacteria colonies growing in there. And then I'm thinking 3 or 4 or 5 years, because I'm composting all my food waste in there too, Dig, over the year.
Oh, awesome, awesome.
And I'm thinking in 4 or 5 years, this little garden spot is just going to be blowing up vegetables out there.
So to clarify for both me and the listener, are you like building up onto the soil and making like almost like a mini raised bed, or are you composting into the existing soil and making just like a regular like strip of like garden?
Well, I keep my compost separate. So the city has the big thing where they let you put all your compost in.
Right.
Well, I take that and fill it up over the year of my food waste, garden waste, and I kind of rotate it and fill it up over the year. And I have a compost area in the back of my yard. Now, I'm kind of lucky like this, I guess, because I had an old stump that I was trying to dig out, old tree. You know how the old trees will keep, keep producing limbs. They'll just keep trying to grow and grow and grow.
Yeah.
Well, I was like, I want to dig this thing up. Because I'm from Alabama, and apparently I just can't stop digging and playing with dirt, apparently. So I was like, I'm going to dig this thing up. And so I had a hole around the stump trying to get it out. And so that's where I compost all my stuff, take and dump all my food waste and my compost in there, mix it in with dirt. And then every summer, now this is taking about a 3 or 4 year process to kind of get this down. Every summer, then I take that compost and mix it all back in with my dirt. That is what I spread over the top of those cardboard rows. And then it's like a mound, like you said, they're like mounded rows. And so I'm able to put out like 3 mounded rows. And that's kind of my system. And I was able to plant some pumpkins, and I got some funny looking squash I planted. And then yesterday I found some old bean seeds and put those in there too. And I'm hoping they'll pop up. Like I was mentioning last show, I kind of struggle with vegetable gardening here because of the sun and the buildings around. I only get like 7 or 8 hours or less of sunlight on the garden every day. So I don't like tomatoes, don't work in my yard at all.
No. And you know, honestly, man, I think if you wanted to grow tomatoes where you're at, I honestly think you might have to use a greenhouse. It's just, it stays so cold so late into the summer there.
Yeah, I've really struggled with tomatoes. I've always like, oh yeah, I'm gonna grow tomatoes. But last year was my last year to even attempt it here on my property. I was like, I'm gonna have to find somewhere else to do this. So how's your garden going?
Good. I stopped growing tomatoes 2 years ago because they attract aphids and tomato hornworm, which will also eat your cannabis plant. So I've been growing peppers. So I've got Hungarian black peppers, which are this like purple pepper that kind of looks like a goth jalapeno almost. It's a really dark colored plant, really pretty. And then I'm growing some rainbow chilies that I make hot sauce out of again. So those are really exciting. And some spiceless habaneros called habanadas. They're supposed to be really good. Those are struggling a bit, but I'm doing a container garden for my peppers this year. So they're all out in the sun now. I've only got a couple more to up pot. And of course, my cannabis is all outdoors, and I actually gave them their first like rinse today. And so they're ready to go, and I'm getting ready to put trellises up.
Really great to hear. And I just wanted to mention to the audience, as I mentioned last show, that our show is now going to be in the Tacoma Public Library. We are officially in there, Dig. I sent you a link for that, and I will make sure to put a link on the show description that we are in the Special Collections now officially in the library. And I mentioned I had a hard time filling out the form and getting it signed. Well, the librarian was nice enough to actually meet me over here nearby the Starbucks at my house and get that signed. So it was really nice of her to do that. So I want to thank the Tacoma Public Library again for having the Cannabis Corner and giving me accommodation and coming out and having me sign this over here in my neighborhood.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thanks, Tacoma Public Library.
And just the next thing is we have a guest coming on by a CEO and founder of Filament Health, a guy by the name of Ben Lightburn. And he is going to be on to talk to us about psilocybin and psilocin. And Filament Health is actually working with the FDA to have the very first approved study, Dig, to give people psilocin, which is kind of a, it's actually, well, tune in later to find out exactly what psilocin is, but is the first study to actually give psilocin extracted right out of mushrooms to patients for a study. So very interesting news coming up later on the Cannabis Corner.
Cool. Yeah. I always like to, you know, hear that someone's using a plant, or in this case, fungal derivatives that actually come from a natural source.
And now, let's check the news.
This is a Cannabis Sativa special report.
In our first story, we're going to start right here at Washington State, and we are going to do something that is not, we're going to talk about a story that is not necessarily just cannabis, but it's talking about the Blake decision. And just a real quick reminder, the Blake decision was a decision by the Washington State Supreme Court back in February 2021 that said Washington State's felony drug possession law was unconstitutional, basically made drugs all across the state of Washington legal, quote, and now counties like King County, and they say there's 150,000 people around the state like this, they are expunging people's records. They don't even have to ask. They're just erasing the records, and they are also refunding court costs and fines, Dig.
Yeah, when I saw that, I was frankly surprised. I thought that my house had flown off and I'd woken up in the Emerald City for real. So usually when the carceral state says we're sorry, like, you know, or they fix something on this scale, they usually don't give the money back. So hearing that they're actually giving the money back, that makes me happy. I'm excited for that. Of course, you know, we have difference of enforcement and stuff, but I'm glad that in some places, at least, they're refunding these court costs and stuff.
And I did say that the expunging of the records is done automatically. However, if you want your money refunded, you have to go fill out some paperwork to get that money refunded. So,
okay.
Yeah. So that is not automatic.
So it's not like they're out looking for people to get their checks. It's not like quite as perfect as I would imagine.
Okay. Nah, but it is at least King County's trying, because in Tacoma, a couple years ago, I asked the Tacoma city attorney to expunge cannabis records all around the city back when that movement was kind of going on. It's still going on. And they sent me a note and said they didn't have the money to do it. So now that King County's doing this, I'm interested to touch base with our county prosecutor and the city attorney and see if what's going to be happening over here in Pierce County. But
so what if we, what if they can't fund it? What if we found funding for them? I mean, I know that's kind of a big deal, but like maybe a grant writer or someone could write a grant for social equity and make them hire a lawyer with that money to do that. Just that and only that.
You know, Dig, that is a really great idea. And that is something that I will mention. When I asked the Pierce County and the city, Pierce County prosecutor and the city attorney, because I'm going to send an email pretty soon, and when they write back and say they can't do it, that'll be the idea we'll come back with.
I mean, it never hurts to try, right?
Yeah, yeah, but they might do it. You never can know. I don't mean to like throw cold water on the idea that Pierce County would do something like King County would, but we over here in Pierce County, they don't tend to reimburse criminals their money. It doesn't seem like something that would go over well over here in Pierce County.
Well, dare to dream.
So our next story is out of Rhode Island, and Rhode Island has become the 19th state to legalize adult use cannabis, and they have made possession of cannabis legal, and dig, they also have home grows.
Hell yeah, they do. Good job.
Yeah, it's really great to see that in Rhode Island, because right now there's only two states that don't have home grows. That's Illinois and Washington State. So I was really happy to see Rhode Island become the 19th state to include that in there, and Rhode Island has been sort of a hotbed. We've covered it on It's a Bus more, I think at least one time. There was a lot of underground grows going on in Rhode Island, and there's all the bigger states around them are legalizing cannabis, and the writing's just like Connecticut, New York. So the writing's on the wall for Rhode Island. I think they just went ahead and wanted to legalize this. But you saw something. This was like an update story. You saw a very interesting note down at the end about something going on in Colleen, Texas.
Right, out in Killeen, out in West Texas, out in oil country. Now, everyone knows that Austin is kind of like the Portland of Texas, right? Kind of liberal, right? They've tried to do decrim measures before, and they just recently passed one. Killeen is not like that at all. Killeen is hyper-capitalist West Texas, football and church, and if you don't like that, it's hell on earth kind of thing. It's not what I – and so when I read this, I was like, oh, what? Killeen? Not San Antonio, not Houston, not Dallas. Little Killeen, Texas activists, say they have turned in more than enough signatures to put a cannabis decriminalization measure on the local ballot. And I said, hats off to those activists in Killeen, and way to – rise above your stereotype.
Yeah, really. And it can get really rural and out in the middle of nowhere out there in Texas. You know, it's if people in Washington State might be familiar with Eastern Washington and how rural and conservative that area is. Well, just imagine that like quadrupled. I mean, as far as how things are spread out and everything. So it is really great to hear, and a big surprise and a really great transition into our next story, which is out of Texas as well. And this is a really neat story out of Texas A&M, and they had to actually go out and find hemp cultivars that would survive the Texas heat, because they passed legal hemp there in Texas and they tried to grow it. And this was a really shocking number, Dig. The first year they did it, they were only able to harvest 5% of the hemp because it's too dang hot in Texas to grow hemp.
Well, and I would like to point out that also we're not just talking about heat. Texas, especially certain parts of Texas, provide some unique environmental challenges to any kind of cannabis cultivation, especially when you're trying to extract flower, right? You've got insects pressure pretty much year-round. Mm-hmm. You don't really get – now, recent history aside, you don't usually get hard freezes to kill off insect population. You don't really get a break from that insect pressure. You have extremely high humidity year-round down in the southeast, which is really, really bad for cannabis flowers to form. So in this article this professor has been doing this hemp cultivation class, and they were able to find and cultivate hemp cultivars that are resistant to these unique Texas, and I would argue probably Delta-wide pressures, Gulf Delta-wide pressures that area provides for cultivators. And I think this will be good not only for hemp cultivation, but for future cannabis cultivation in Texas. And something that people aren't thinking about is this is churning out a classroom full of kids over and over again that know how to cultivate cannabis. And once you've taught someone that skill, you can't really control what they do with it. So not only is it's not really that interesting to me that they're growing hemp, but they are growing young minds that are ready to cultivate cannabis. And that excites me. Now, one thing I will say to these college students that are coming out of these cannabis cultivation programs into the cultivation space in a professional level, I would say that the best way to learn to grow weed is still on the job. If you get a job in industry after this school, keep your mouth shut and learn for the first month. There's usually a reason why people do things, even if they can't figure out how to tell you. Watch and learn, and then you can add value.
Right. These are master's and PhD students, and they are coming out, and I think on top of being a great resource, and like you said, you know, they're going to go to other states. Let's say some of these folks would move to Rhode Island. Well, they'll know how to do their home grows there because the cannabis plant, because they are growing hemp, but these things are still big, sticky flowers, and they have all the terpenes and a lot of some of the cannabinoids on them, less than 3% THC, of course. Yep. But, you know, they still are cannabis plants, and things like, I think things like this are making it possible over there in Colleen, Texas, because, you know, you're having professionals coming out that are familiar with the plant. It's not that devil weed idea anymore. It's like, oh, this is just a plant. And by the way, it's a really cool plant. Cannabis plant. I've been around a lot of plants, Dig, and I always keep saying it's one of the coolest plants out there.
It's very pretty.
All right, on to our next story. And this is a story that we've been covering for a while now. And this is the Delta 8 phenomenon going on, or the Delta 8 scourge going on, whichever one you want to say. It can be both, depending on which side of the fence you're on and what part of the industry you're in, whether you're a patient or where you live. And so just as a reminder, Delta 8, for the most part, right now in the United States, I want to stick to the United States right now because Delta 8 is, I don't think this is going on around the world a lot. So right now it's being synthesized from CBD, which is being derived from hemp. And basically, the best I can tell, and from everything I've read, they had a lot of CBD sort of sitting around. They didn't know what to do with it. And they decided, they already knew how to find out. They already knew how to make Delta 8. Delta 8 has been around all the way, I think, before actually Delta 9. So they've already known this molecule's been there for a long time. And so then they converted all that CBD sitting around in the warehouses here and there, and they made it into the Delta 8. And now it's just become this big profitable thing. Is like, what do you call it, Dig? What do you say Delta 8 is compared to? What kind of beer?
I called it near beer. It's basically like a non-alcoholic beer. It has less than 3% in it. It, you know, it's kind of like a beer. It's close to a beer, but it's not quite a beer. And that's kind of how I feel about Delta 8. I understand, like, and we've talked about this. Medical patients in states where cannabis isn't legal, a lot of times they can turn to Delta 8 and it can do some of the things that whole plant cannabis can do. But I wish people would just legalize the plant, because Delta 8 is not good enough. It's not as good as the real thing. And I think people just need to understand that. It's close, but it's not quite as good. And I think people need to have access to all types of cannabis. Not just hemp, not just CBD, not just Delta 8. I think they need to be able to have access to the so-called drug cultivars as well, so they can decide how to treat their body. I don't think the market needs to decide that. I don't think the law enforcement entities need to decide that. I don't think the government needs to decide that. And I think Delta 8, you know, may have a place in the future when all cannabis is legal, but I think it'll be a much smaller place.
And the question of Delta 8 has been kicking around the courts. Lots of legislatures have tried to deal with it. The Washington State LCB, they pretty much outright have banned it. But in this case, a federal appeals court has now said that Delta 8 is legal. And so I feel like this is just going to keep on going up through the courts. And I'm not sure what's going to happen if it makes it all the way up to the Supreme Court, because the DOJ just asked the Supreme Court to stay out of cannabis policy. So I think this Delta 8 is going to be around for a long time. And I too have sort of changed my mind on Delta 8. I was really against it when I first heard about it, because it's being very disruptive here in Washington State with some of the extractors. And because people are substituting Delta 8 for Delta 9 in some cases. So right. It has been a little disruptive to the market. I worry about the home growers, not the home growers, but like the small 502 growers, and how it disrupts that small market.
Right.
But you know, like you said, I had a personal story on this. I had a friend of mine contact me. I knew him from way back in 1999, and he was looking me up on the internet. He had already seen that I was a cannabis writer, reporter, and did a class over at TCC. Well, he actually contacted me, wanting me to help him out with a friend of his who had cancer. Well, he lives in Tennessee, and best I can tell him is try to find some cannabis, but you got to be super careful. You know, don't get yourself thrown in jail. And but one thing that struck me, and I was like, oh, wow, it just kind of occurred to me, like, hey, get your friends some Delta 8. And he said that they actually did get some Delta 8, and they were able to find it. And I haven't heard whether it helped him out, helped his friend out or anything. But I sort of changed my view on this. Like you said, I think this helps people that can't get their hands on the Delta 9 THC. But, you know, we just need to legalize the real Delta 9 and then let Delta 8 find its place in a legal market, not this continuous sort of police state. We'll pick Delta 8 here, Delta 9 here.
Right, because I'm not saying Delta 8 doesn't have a place medicinally. It might do stuff that Delta 9 doesn't do. But right now, from where I'm sitting, it seems like it's a pale substitution for what people are getting it for. That's all I'm saying. That I'm not saying that's even always the case. I've known some traditional cannabis consumers that have Delta 8 in their cannabis use rotation. I don't personally care for it, but your mileage may vary. I generally don't like a lot of processes in my medicine. The least step amount of steps I can take from, you know, the plant to me, that makes me happier. So, but sometimes, you know, I take an aspirin. So there's that.
Yeah. And just if you are out there and you are someone who is taking Delta 8, just make sure that you're careful, because it is known that there's like a mystery meat that comes out of this at the end, that they don't even really have lab protocols set up to test some of the stuff that comes out, some of the waste products. So they're synthesizing Delta 8 from CBD, and they're also synthesizing Delta 9 from CBD too, kind of the same sort of process. And this is kind of wild. You can't tell the difference between synthesized Delta 9 and Delta 9 from the plant. And that's kind of, that's something that's even a little bit more worrisome to me than the Delta 8, especially seeing as some of the crazy chemical processes that go in and doing it.
Yeah, I mean, all this stuff is just reinforcing my idea that if you can grow at home, golly gee, you should try, because you know that the cannabis you grow at home, you know what you sprayed on it, or if you sprayed anything on it at all. You knew the, so if you're really thorough, you might even know the pH of the water you gave to it. You can control what you give to the plant, and you can make the plant, you know, a little bit safer for you. And if you're relying on someone else to supply your medicine, there's just additional steps and additional chances it can be adulterated, abused, or not done properly.
This episode of the Cannabis Corner is brought to you by Quality West Cannabis. Learn more at thecannabiscorner840.blogspot.com. And we are back this week with our interview, and today we are joined by Ben Lightburn, and Ben is the founder and CEO of Filament Health, and he is going to be here to talk to us today about psilocybin, and a very interesting study that his company Filament is going to be doing with the, or a FDA-approved study Filament Health is going to be doing on psilocin and psilocybin. How are you doing today, Ben?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's really great to have you on the show, and I want to thank you for taking the time to come on with us today. And before I get started with our interview, I just want to mention something that we have mentioned before on the Cannabis Corner when it comes to cannabis. Just because, and I want to mention this on the topic of psilocybin, just because we are speaking in a positive light on the topic of psilocybin, in no way is the Cannabis Corner recommending or suggesting that you use psilocybin or any other entheogen. These are very powerful substances, and we suggest that you speak with an expert or someone before you use these substances to be safe. And then secondly, I want to acknowledge and recognize the role indigenous peoples have had over the centuries of bringing these entheogens and substances up to the 21st century. And I want to recognize and acknowledge, without some of those groups around the world, we would know far less about entheogens and things like psilocybin. I was really fascinating to read exactly what Filament Health is doing. And you are getting naturally extracted entheogens and doing some different things with them. So tell us a little bit about your background, and how does somebody get into starting a psilocybin and entheogen company?
Yeah, it's a good question. I often wonder myself, what's the answer? I've been working in the area of botanical extraction my whole career. What that means is working on ways of getting high value compounds out of natural sources like plants or fungi, obviously, and then selling those extracts into a variety of different industries. I was fortunate enough to be part of a company that that exited a few years ago. This is a company called Matza Innovation, where we commercialized a new kind of extraction technology using something called subcritical water to replace solvent extraction. Anyways, we sold that company a couple of years ago, and noticed that with the rise of the psychedelics industry, it was very peculiar to us that all the focus and attention seemed to be on synthetically manufactured substances. And while there isn't anything really wrong with manufacturing psilocybin or any other compound through artificially through a process of chemical synthesis, we believe strongly that people actually prefer natural substances. And we thought that we would start a company in order to provide people with that natural option should they so choose.
So when you speak about natural psychedelics, what type of natural psychedelics are you producing at Filament Health?
So we work with all different kinds of natural psychedelics. Predominantly at the moment, it's products that we extract from magic mushroom, from the Psilocybe cubensis, as well as other species. And we look at lots of different strains of magic mushrooms. But interestingly, our license, our controlled substances license, actually permits us to work with all controlled natural psychedelics. So I have here in my room mescaline containing cactus. You know, we're working with ayahuasca, we're working with salvia, all different, essentially all different naturally sourced psychedelic substances and compounds.
Very interesting. And I just wanted to ask real quick, when we take psilocybin, I'm wondering if you could just speak for a minute, what happens in our body when we take psilocybin? Because it's well known that these substances have a pretty fairly powerful effect on the body. So can you shed a little light on what is actually happening in the brain when we take these?
Great question. When we take psilocybin, the first thing that needs to happen is it needs to be converted into a related compound called psilocin in order for it to become active in the human body. It's not something that is widely known, but psilocybin is something that's called a prodrug, meaning that it needs to convert into the active form or the drug before it can become active in the human body. So that's the first thing that needs to happen. Psilocin itself is a serotonin analog. That means that it activates the serotonin receptors, and that's really what's thought to be responsible for most of the hallucinogenic and therapeutic effects. We don't actually know fully what causes or how these effects play out in the brain or why the therapeutic effect is evident. And in fact, that's why it's so important that we conduct more and more research in order to find out the answers. We kind of know from preliminary research that it seems to work, but we don't necessarily know why. And that's part of the reason why this research is so fascinating.
Yeah, because of the drug war, it really has been delayed, a lot of this research. The same thing with cannabis. But it seems like we are really getting into more of a renaissance of all these. It was really looked into deeply in the late 60s, early 70s, but it kind of seemed like it was put on the shelf for about 40 years, and now it's on the comeback as far as the studies go. My next question is, so I wanted to ask you, why do these substances work well for mental health therapy?
Well, like I said before, the why isn't actually that well known. It's thought to increase neuroplasticity, and to sometimes you hear people say that it resets the brain, resets the default mode network. But again, like a lot of this is quite preliminary and in the early stages. Not a lot is actually known about why these substances seem to have a very, very good therapeutic effect.
I was looking at your website and you mentioned the entourage effect, and that is something that we talk a lot about on the Cannabis Corner, the terpenes working along with the cannabinoids. And we were just speaking with a guest a couple shows back, even flavonoids, when you consume cannabis in its different ways. So what is going on with the entourage effect when we are taking mushrooms or psilocybin?
It's often people try to draw comparisons between cannabis and psychedelics in terms of the, you know, the industry and the rollout. And this is actually one of the areas in which you can actually draw good parallels. If everybody knows that cannabis contains much more than just a THC, but the same thing is equally true for magic mushrooms and for other natural psychedelics. Magic mushrooms contain much more than just psilocybin. There are many other minor compounds such as psilocin, baeocystin, norbaeocystin, norpsilocin, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the entourage effect is the idea that these other compounds working together in concert with the primary compound can have some kind of therapeutic benefit, if as opposed to if you just were to take the primary compound in isolation or on its own. Importantly, when you make a compound through a process of chemical synthesis, you'll only ever make that primary compound, psilocybin in the case of magic mushrooms. But our extracts and in general, natural extracts, contain all of these other secondary metabolites, as they're called, alongside. And up till now, no clinical trials have actually used naturally sourced psychedelic substances. Therefore, it's been impossible to actually measure whether or not there are any benefits from the entourage effect. We like to say that, you know, whether or not it does exist is a very important question. And without someone to make natural extracts, it's impossible to actually study it.
And that is a great segue into my next question, which is about this trial, this study that you are about to participate, that is actually the first Federal Drug Administration approved study, and it's going to be using naturally extracted psilocybin from magic mushrooms. It's the first one of its kind. So tell us a little bit about that study, and what do you hope to find in this study?
So we were very, very proud to get FDA authorization to proceed with this trial. As you mentioned, it's the first time the FDA has authorized the use of naturally sourced psychedelics in a clinical trial. It's also the first time that the FDA has authorized a trial which will directly administer psilocin rather than, as I mentioned before, the prodrug of psilocybin. So this trial is actually designed to look at, to see if there are any benefits associated with administering psilocin directly. Because the psilocin doesn't need to have this conversion step in order to become active in the human body, we think that there could be a faster onset time and associated with that a shorter overall duration. Also, because the conversion from psilocybin into psilocin is thought to primarily occur in the gut, we think that it could be a contributing factor with gastrointestinal upset side effects. So we think that psilocin will actually have a lower side effect profile. But most importantly, we're excited to see whether there's evidence supporting the fact that perhaps psilocin can provide a more consistent therapeutic response. Because different people have different amount of the enzyme required to convert the psilocybin into the psilocin, this actually produces quite a variable therapeutic effect when you take psilocybin orally. So we think that by giving the psilocin directly, we think we can have a much more consistent response, which is better for everybody, especially when you can reduce the number of non-responders to oral psilocybin therapy.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. There might be some people listening to the show right now that might want to learn more about this study and might want to try to participate. And by the way, this is at the University of California, San Francisco, I believe. How can people find more about this study if they might want to try and participate?
Yes, you're right. The trial is taking place at UCSF. In order to participate, people should go to clinicaltrials.gov. Look up our trial, and then, in fact, we'll be recruiting in the next few weeks. So if there are people in the Bay Area that are interested to participate, I encourage them to go look at clinicaltrials.gov. A good keyword to type in on the website would probably be psilocin, because we're the only trial to come up that's directly administering psilocin.
Yeah, I'll make sure I'll put a link to that in the show description to where to find more information about the clinical trial there. Okay. So I saw that Canada is making some moves on the federal front when it comes to legalizing psilocybin. I believe I read that Filament Health is in Canada. Can you speak for a minute on how close is Canada nationally? How close are you to legalizing psilocybin?
It's another great question, and one we think about a lot. We don't know we don't have any insight into the brains of the bureaucrats in Ottawa. But one thing that has happened to signal progress in Canada is that recently the government restored access to psilocybin through something called the Special Access Program. In the United States, it's called Expanded Access. It's a program where patients that are in urgent emergency need can apply for access to experimental drugs. Before the beginning of this year, you couldn't actually apply for psilocybin through the Special Access Program, but Health Canada changed that around, and now you can. So we are seeing a large number of people interested and applying for access. While this is not a legal market, sort of like a broad, it's legal. While it's not a broad market by any stretch of the imagination, what it is exciting about it is that we're seeing Health Canada kind of, you know, show willingness to listen to the evidence and that these products can be safe and effective, and make regulatory changes reflecting that opinion. Some people think that we might see a access to medical psilocybin regulations similarly to what we saw with medical cannabis 10 or 15 years ago in Canada. So some people think that day may not be too far away. But for now, we're just focused on developing psilocybin and psilocin-containing drugs as pharmaceutical products, for which there already is a legal market, obviously a legal way to distribute these drugs.
To get us out of here, how can people get in touch with you? And if they want to learn more about this, what Filament Health is doing, where can people find your website?
Our website is filament.health, and I would encourage people to go check it out. Check us out on social media, and in particular, I would encourage people to sign up for our mailing list, where they can get lots of really interesting information and lots of pretty pictures featuring really cool mushrooms and things like that.
All right, that sounds really cool. So again, thank you very much for being on the show today, and I hope you have a great day.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much.
This episode of the Cannabis Corner is brought to you by Quality West Cannabis. Learn more at thecannabiscorner840.blogspot.com.
Our last segment of the show is our It's a Bus segment. And this segment of the show, we continue to look at the drug war going on all around the United States and the world. And this is an interesting story out of Detroit. And here we have another situation where the drug war is still just kicking on. It's like every day, it's like something you'd read in 1982, this story. They actually found a very large cannabis shipment in Detroit. Give us some of the details of that shipment, Dig.
Yeah, it was It was hidden in a shipment labeled pool toys, which the article seemed to find humorous. It was 2,100 pounds. And it was in a tractor trailer. And that's pretty much the most of the details we got. It's a lot of cannabis. And it kind of surprised me. I didn't realize that large packages of cannabis were still coming across the border from Canada. I naively had thought that our domestic cannabis cultivation would be keeping up with domestic cannabis demand. So this is kind of interesting to me. Yeah.
Yeah, and I did a story a while back on Gondrepreneurs about this and the continued importation of cannabis from Canada. And they had a law enforcement official saying that if you went out and looked across the body of water that's in between Detroit and Canada, probably should know that, but I'm not coming to mind right now, that the guy said that you could see miles and miles of cannabis greenhouses lit up out there at night. Because on the other side over there, that's out in the hinterlands of Canada, you know what I mean? It's not urban in a lot of places. So they are using the backcountry of Canada to grow all this cannabis, and then they're sending it right across the border in Detroit, which goes down to Nebraska, where you see it busted 200 pounds. It goes down to Tennessee, where they busted 500 pounds, you know? So it just continues this, and it's almost like they're letting it happen, and this police state is just still chucking along, Dig.
Yeah, it's, you know, as long as we have patchwork legalization and patchwork laws, and we don't allow mature markets to supply themselves in mature ways, we're always going to have problems. And I just don't see any other way about it. We need to limit enforcement and legalize international cannabis import and export. And the only way we can do that is to either completely deschedule, like hands-off cannabis, and then if we run into problems, we'll legislate. Or you set up some horrible framework where everybody can grift off of, like in Washington, where your OLCC is running around with guns and stealing money and whatever, allegedly, and doing all kinds of nonsense stuff and driving players out of the market that they don't like and stuff. We could do that, or we could just completely go wide open for a little while and see how it plays out and then fix the problems we run into. And that's what I think we need to do.
Yeah, descheduling is a big solution to this, and it would go a long ways just to end the whole thing, or at least get it down to a schedule two or even further down. So really great show today, Dig. I want to thank you for being on the show. I also want to thank Ben Lightburn for being on the show. And for people listening and the subscribers out there to The Cannabis Corner, you can find us over at The Cannabis Corner at thecannabiscorner840.blogspot.com. So want to thank everybody for tuning in the show and hope you have a great week, Dig.
Yeah, you too.
If you have questions or would like to comment on the show, you can reach us at thecannabiscorner840@gmail.com. To listen to back episodes or to subscribe to the show, find us all across the internet by searching The Cannabis Corner. How can folks get in touch with you, Dig?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at Uncle Dig, and you can listen to my podcast, The Bagseed Chronicles, wherever you get podcasts.
Thank you to Radio Tacoma and KTQA for their continued support. I'd also like to thank Aaron Folsch for his production assistance. And finally, thank you for joining us on The Cannabis Corner.